When I started the show 13 years ago, it was just me wearing all the hats. But as it's grown, so has the team to support it. And I'm super grateful to Adam for his editing skills, for Ava, who produces the video versions that you see on YouTube, to Sheila, who does the detailed write-ups for the Side Hustle Nation website, and to Teresa, who uploads everything to all the different podcast apps. When you're a small business, the right hire can be make or break. And that's why when you need to get it right, think this is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, and more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs. Side Hustle Show listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs. One idea, one side hustle can change your life. It did for me, and it did for today's guest. 18 months ago, he was making good money at his day job, but in his words, it felt like he was always building somebody else's business. Maybe that is familiar. Maybe you can relate to that. Enter The Side Hustle, an e-commerce store focused on the UK market, selling camper van and motorhome accessories. He took it to 40 grand a month while still working that day job. And now, remember, it's only been 18 months, he's doing over 120,000 in monthly sales. From campernation.co.uk, Phil McElhaney. Welcome to The Side Hustle Show.
Hi, Nick. Yeah, thanks for having me here.
Absolutely. Stick around in this one. We're talking market research slash niche selection and the fast track and low risk way to fill your store with inventory, and then the marketing methods that are working to drive profitable sales. But Phil, kick us off. Why Side Hustle? What inspired you to get this thing started?
The idea of owning a business or starting a side hustle wasn't something that I can say, you know, hasn't been there since I was a kid. I wasn't the kid selling lemonade at a lemonade stand or anything like that. I followed the sort of traditional route that you get encouraged to go down, I think particularly in the UK, of trying to get good grades at school, go to a good university, get a good education, get a solid job, work your way up, and then ultimately end up working in that career for the rest of your life. And I think I got a little way down that track, hit 30, found myself in a pretty good middle management type role, but then I kind of thought, is this me now? Is that me for the next 30, 40 years where, you know, promotions are getting slower the higher up I go? I'm reliant on a boss for a pay rise. I've got to live within a commuter belt of London and travel in, you know, a few times a week to go to work. And, you know, if I have kids at some point, am I going to be barely seeing them because I'm chained to an office the whole time? So that's when the idea really started coming around, and I thought I've got to do something to change it.
What attracted you to e-commerce specifically as this is the path I'm going to take?
I think one thing that really attracted me to e-commerce was that I knew that if I could build this into an actual business, there's a real asset value to it. And the thought of maybe being able to sell it at some point in the future has been something that was kind of in my mind from relatively early on.
Yeah, I think that's very forward thinking as a new-ish entrepreneur, because this was definitely not on my radar early on. It was like, oh, I could build a sellable asset, and have exited only one little project of mine so far. But it is this idea of building near-term cash flow and equity value, where every $1,000 that I can add on a monthly basis to the business is, you know, worth $3,000 or so, you know, whatever it is in terms of the multiple that is worth. It's really a powerful wealth-building unlock. And I love this call at the beginning, this kind of moment of self-reflection. You know, hit 30 years old. Is this me? Is this really what the next 30 years is going to look like? Staring at the same cubicle walls, making the same commute. And it hits you. And as you're like, oh, dude, there's got to be another way. There's got to be another path. So you decide, I'm going to take a shot at an e-commerce business. You have, now the day job we should mention is in digital marketing for an agency. So there are some online skills, some digital marketing skills kind of in your back pocket. But what goes into the product selection process? Or how do you figure out, well, okay, I want to do an e-commerce business, but what am I going to sell?
I think a big thing with me was I was thinking from a risk-averse point of view. I wanted to start something where I could maybe get it up and running, make a bit of money from it, and see a bit of long-term future for it while still doing a day job. So it needs to be something I can do on my evenings and weekends, and it's not going to take up too much time and, you know, leave me trying to spin too many plates at once.
Yeah.
And that led me down the path then of like, okay, if I want to work back for how much money in profit I want to make, how much do I need to sell? How many orders does that look like? How much traffic is that going to require to come in, getting through to the website? And it all led me to a pretty clear path of going after high ticket e-commerce products. So not little sort of $15 trinkets that you might ship over from China or somewhere. I went very much after products that are retailing for $1,000 plus. And so you could be making anything from $150 up to a few thousand dollars of profit in every sale on one of those. So that was a kind of a key criteria really for me from the starting point.
Okay, lower volume, but you know, higher transaction value per sale.
Exactly that. You've got to sell a lot of $10, $15 products to make the sort of money that's going to ultimately replace your income if you're earning anywhere decent money and you know, you're in a kind of any sort of job where you're trying to replace that. You've got to sell a lot of low ticket stuff to be able to do it, whereas you don't need a lot of high ticket sales to be able to do that.
Where do you even start from this niche selection, or like if you're coming into it kind of idea agnostic, or like you're open to the possibilities, like where do we even start in terms of like, well, what could I sell?
I think if you went into the your day-to-day life with an idea of I'm going to look for products that could be retailing for $1,000 or more, and you started taking a look around your environment when you go to work, when you go out anywhere, I think you'd be surprised how many things are actually sold every day for that type of money. Myself personally, I can't claim that I'm going out and buying these products. I don't have a really big passion or a hobby that's requiring me to buy really, really expensive products. So I went down much more of a sort of data-led route with it. So I was looking at main criteria being, is there a person that I can sell this to? So not just an individual product, but is there a person with a passion who I can sell multiple products to potentially, who is willing to invest their time and money into this type of thing and wants to get a good product? And so I started researching those products. I'm also looking at things like search volume. So is there a good amount of search volume for those products, the product type, the brands involved in them, and are there people selling these products online that don't have a physical store? Those were kind of things that I'm going through and ticking off and finding different niches that are fitting that criteria essentially.
So it would be a green flag if it's somewhat hard to come by locally. So like I want to have not a great selection at a physical store nearby. Like that was part of the thought process.
Yes. You almost want it to be a specialized product. So it's the sort of product that someone needs to potentially go to a specialized store for them. So you don't want to be selling things that are hugely branded either. There needs to be some recognition there, but you don't want to be selling Sony TVs or Nike shoes or something like that. But these need to be products ideally with some sort of brand behind them. And you really want to be looking for suppliers that are based in your local market. So if you're in the US, you'll be selling products that are owned by a US company. They're either made in the US or they're shipped in from somewhere else to the US. So they're all shipped out locally. They're on quick delivery. They're not taking months to come across from somewhere else.
So you eventually land on camper van and motorhome accessories, but what else made the shortlist? I'm curious, what other categories did you consider?
I think there's a few really common ones that a lot of people I know in this type of business seem to come up on the same lists. And so things like wellness products was a big one that I looked at, but I saw a lot of competition there. So things like saunas, cold plunges, that type of thing. It can definitely work, but I think there's a lot of competition around it. I also looked at kind of stuff that someone who has a man cave might be interested in. So your things like pool tables, foosball tables, jukeboxes, that type of stuff. That was one that I considered quite a bit as well. I actually kind of moved away from that a bit because I saw that there was a lot of D2C brands in that space, and that's kind of one thing I try to steer clear of a little bit, is I prefer to work with suppliers who concentrate on making really good products but aren't selling them directly to people themselves. They need people like me and other businesses to come in and sell it for them. But that was another big one. Home gym equipment was another one as well. But yeah, I ended up settling on RVs, caravans, motorhomes, Not that I'm a person who does that myself, but just because that's what the data told me.
Yeah, that was the next question. Like, are you a hashtag van lifer yourself, or just like, no, this is where the numbers led me?
I understand and see the appeal of it. It's not like I can't say to you that I'm going out every weekend in a van and pitching up next to a lake and composting toilet at all. But I can see the appeal of like that kind of van life. So, but yeah, it's not something I'm actively doing myself.
You could put yourself in the mind of the customer without necessarily having to be the customer yourself. And what's interesting here is instead of being the go-to person for portable power stations, or I'm looking at the site now, caravan awnings, it's going like one level broader. And you kind of said like, who could I sell, the type of person I could sell multiple products to under this same category umbrella, versus being like, I'll be your one-stop shop for all things backyard sauna, or it's something, it's a little bit broader than that, which I think is interesting.
I do think part of that is being in a smaller market than the US here, I would say. In the UK, I think in particular, it's better to go after the type of thing where there's a few products that you could sell. I do think that's still the best approach to do, even in the US as well. But I think that there's a bit more scope because of the market size to specialize down a little bit more. So into, say, your example, you could be the sauna company and you sell lots of different types of saunas. Whereas in the UK, I would say maybe I'd be selling saunas and hot tubs and cold plunges to try and build out that potential sort of market size.
Okay, that's a helpful distinction. Now, you mentioned search volume being part of the criteria. What metrics are you looking for? What tools are you using to kind of get a gauge of what that interest is?
I used Ubersuggest back in the day to get the keyword volume, and I was basically searching the broad product categories. So if it was saunas, I'd be searching sauna, outdoor sauna, infrared sauna, and getting the search volumes from those. And I was looking for something in the region of a total collection of those of 20,000 plus monthly searches from them is going to give you enough volume to know that there's enough people actively looking for those products.
Did the competitiveness come into factor here too, where it's like, okay, all else being equal, sure, I'll look for something with 20,000 searches, 50,000 searches, 100,000 searches, but I got to imagine there's another Phil out there, there's another Nick out there who's putting on their entrepreneurial cap and saying, well, if that's a good niche, maybe I should start a little business in this area too. And I'm curious what the competitive landscape looked like, or if that was a deciding factor.
Yeah, definitely. So I'd say that working through it methodically, the stuff around the products and the price being the first one, the person feeding into that, the search volume being the next. And then I would say once I know that it's hit those criteria, I'm going away looking at some of the potential brands that I could be selling products for in that niche. And I'm going onto the shopping results in Google and seeing how many other online direct competitors are there in that space. So I want to see that there are some other companies that are able to sell these products online only, i.e. they don't have a physical premises, they're essentially drop shipping them. But I don't really want to be seeing in the US probably upwards of 20 direct competitors in there. I want to see enough to know that there is room for online sellers, but I don't want to see so much that it's going to just be a complete nightmare and highly competitive space.
How many is too many?
I think in the US, 20 plus direct competitors, and I don't mean Amazon or big box stores. I mean someone else who's basically doing a similar or the same business model as me and targeting like the same core people.
So I want to see some, because there's some validation and proof of concept. But if there's 20, then it's like, let me go find another niche or go maybe one level more niche down.
Yes. I would say there's going to be someone that proves me wrong in this and someone finds a golden nugget niche that no one's thought of and it's the best idea and you're the first person doing it. But I think realistically nowadays, if you can't find online sellers doing a product that's got that 20,000 plus monthly volume on it, there's probably a reason that they're not being sold online for something or another. So yeah, that's the one thing probably I would caution around that.
Okay. And the other important point here is we're trying to sell products that have existing demand, right? Easier to fill demand than to create it. And we're going to try and sell products that are already established. We're not inventing anything ourselves. We're trying to become a new sales channel or hopefully drive incremental sales for some of these manufacturers, some of these businesses that already exist. And so this is the next step in the process. We can say, okay, I like this camper van niche. The research checks out. What comes after that?
So I think once you've decided on everything, you just need to get a bit of skin in the game and put a bit of time into it. And the way to do that is get your website up and running. You don't want to be ringing up suppliers. Their phones are probably ringing all the time. You don't want to be ringing them up as someone that's not even got a website live, that's got nothing. They're going to see you probably as a bit of a chancer. So the next thing would be to go get a website, get it looking at, to a decent level, design the homepage, put a little bit of content on there, put some demo products on there, get a list of suppliers together that you potentially want to sell the products for, and just start contacting them. I think you'll be surprised how many of them have on their websites themselves some kind of dealer page where you can apply to become an authorized retailer, which is what we're doing. We're going to be authorized to sell their products. So just fill those out if they have them. Try and call them and speak to someone directly, speak to a sales manager, and just explain a little bit about what you're looking to do and the value you can bring, and you can take it from there. I think you'd be surprised how willing people are to try and get more sales for their business. It's a mutually beneficial arrangement that you're going to them with.
Yeah, if they're open to this type of relationship, it's no skin off their back, really. It's like, sure, we can onboard you. If you sell something, you know, we'll ship it for you, basically. It's like, it's all incremental, hopefully.
Exactly. And you're going to be their best customer because you will, at the start, initially, you will pay for every order before it ships. So they're not going to be chasing you for 30-day payment terms.
True, true.
You're not asking to take on any type of credit or anything like that. And you're going to adhere to any of their brand guidelines and anything else that they've got from you. All they need to do really is send you the information on the products and you can take care of everything else.
Was there anything in your initial outreach, like in these authorized reseller applications or in these cold calls to the sales managers, what do you think got you through and got a yes, got you approved versus somebody else?
I think some of it is just picking up the phone. I think a lot of people, if they're trying to start something like this, they might be going into it with a mindset a little bit too much that it's a passive income stream. And to be clear, it's not a passive income stream. It's something that can give you financial and location freedom, but it's not passive. So I think actually just showing that I was a real person, having a conversation with someone, listening to what they said, and just presenting myself as professionally as I could, I think that went a long way, to be honest, to sort of getting people to give me a little bit of a chance at the start.
And then nuts and bolts, you do get that stamp of approval and they give you access to their product catalog and you can start listing those on your own site. How many yeses, how many different products do you feel like you need to like launch, so to speak, so that it looks like a built out e-com site?
Less than you think, because at the start in particular, your traffic is all going to be coming to your product pages. In this type of business, you start with advertising. That's going to be your traffic source. You're not going to get any organic SEO traffic for a good few months or year at this point.
Yeah.
So actually, I think the number of people that are going to be going all around your site and judging how few products you have is probably less than you think. So I think I got 4 brands products up on my site when I started. And that was just because I think I'd maybe reached out to 20 or something. It was just like, oh, the first few I get, I'll get everything up and I'll get some ads running and I'll add more later on.
Okay.
You could do it with one. You could do one product even. Probably less than I would do in an ideal world. But if you get one, all you need is one yes to get a start and you can make sales with that.
Yeah, you can build out that one landing page. And if that's the only page that you're driving pay traffic to, then they see it, they either buy or they don't buy. And it's unlikely that they're really poking around for a bunch of other stuff.
At least at first, yeah. There's definitely more to add to that later. But at the start, using the type of ads that we did, which I think we'll probably chat through as well. Yeah, you don't need more than that.
This is another on the just product or niche selection criteria. Picking something that has a breadth of different suppliers to pull from, because okay, it took 20 contacts to get those first 4 yeses. You wouldn't want to have a niche where there's only 4 suppliers and I could only get one. Yeah. And now it's like, well, this is a little bit tricky. This is not the vision that I had when I started this thing.
No, it's a good point. I think having a good spread of potential suppliers that you can deal with is definitely a really big tick to anything. We were kind of looking at sort of 10 plus was a good number to be able to get. And if there's more than that, then great.
Okay. So targeting these products that are $1,000 or more, maybe £1,000 or more, and getting them listed on the site. And now comes the game of kind of proving yourself to these suppliers who've taken a chance on you and say, yeah, we can onboard you. We'll see if you make any sales. And so now it's on you to go and deliver those sales. And like you said, it starts with paid advertising and trying to make a margin, trying to play in this space between the cost of traffic and what that traffic is ultimately worth in terms of conversion. What's going on in terms of this paid traffic strategy? Phil's detailed breakdown of his 3-tiered paid traffic strategy is coming up right after this. Big parenting milestone for us this month. I finally set up investing accounts for the kids. It had been on the to-do list for a while, but it was a chance to talk about the power of compound interest and making money without working for it directly. I think what was most exciting for them was the concept of owning a small piece of a ton of different businesses, and that a lot of the traffic on the road is people going to work for those companies, doing their small part to make them a little bit richer. We also offered a very generous parental match to incentivize them to continue to fund their accounts. But this brings me to my favorite financial tool, Monarch. It's the easy-to-use financial dashboard to track your spending, savings, investments, and more all in one place. I love the net worth tracker, and especially zooming out 6, 12, 24 months and seeing how much progress we've made. I want to invite you to write your own money story with Monarch. Use code SIDEHUSTLE at monarch.com to get your first year of Monarch Core half off at just $50. That's 50% off your first year at monarch.com with code SIDEHUSTLE. You know, when you're working for a company and payday just automatically happens every couple weeks? Simple, reliable, easy. But now flip it. You're the boss, it's your business, and you need to pay yourself and your team. That's where our partner Gusto comes in. Gusto is online payroll and benefits software built for small businesses. It's all in one, remote friendly, and incredibly easy to use. So you can pay, hire, onboard, and support your team from anywhere. I've been on an automation kick this year, so Gusto's automatic payroll tax filing is right up my alley. Plus, you can set up simple direct deposits, health benefits, 401ks, you name it. Gusto makes it easy and affordable. There's no hidden fees, no surprises, and it's no wonder why 500,000 small businesses already trust Gusto for their payroll and HR needs. I want to invite you to try Gusto today at gusto.com/sidehustle and get 3 months free when you run your first payroll. That's 3 months of free payroll at gusto.com/sidehustle. One more time, it's Gusto, GUSTO.com/sidehustle.
It's not anything that my professional background really prepared me for. So I know that you mentioned I'd worked in digital marketing previously. I think when you're spending maybe $100,000 on LinkedIn ads for a big tech company, that's very different to dipping $500 out of your own pocket and trying to run some ads to Shopify, just to say that at the start. So yeah. This is something anyone can learn. But the big thing we're trying to do at the start really is we're going after the traffic that's going to come from the absolute bottom funnel searches on Google. So the people that are ready to buy there and then, that's where we want our ad spend to be going. I was doing that through Google Shopping ads. So these are the ads, they appear as images, they've got the price and the product name on there. They don't require any creativity from you to do anything. You don't need to go away and make any videos or anything or ads. It's all taken directly from your page. So that was how I got that set up. Whenever you try and set these types of ads up, Google will try and force its AI, all its automations at you straight away. But I would caution you to not press the easy button and avoid these things like Performance Max. I've never used it. I've never seen anything that says it works better than a manual approach for high ticket. And I think if everyone's using it, then where's your competitive advantage? So I went down a manual shopping campaign setup.
And so it pulls from your product catalog and is low lift, it sounds like. I don't have to come up with ad creative. I don't have to come up with user-generated content. I don't have to come up with these hooky short-form videos or anything. It's just like, look, here's the product. Here's the price. You know, here's the landing page. And it will show up for what sounds like the specific search queries where it's like, we're not looking at camper van awnings. That's too broad. But we're like, if there was a specific brand name plus camper van awning plus, you know, 10 feet by 16 feet, you know, something very, very specific.
Exactly that. The way you would set this up is you would have three shopping campaigns. You have an upper funnel campaign, medium funnel campaign, and a bottom funnel campaign. And what we essentially want to do is be getting as much of the traffic as possible from that bottom funnel campaign. In shopping ads, unlike search text ads in Google, we're not setting the keywords that we want our ads to appear for. If you set a search text ad campaign, you can put a really specific exact match or phrase match term in there and your ads will only show for that. But what we're doing for shopping is that it works the opposite way as that. So you can only use exclusion lists, negative keyword lists. So you set up those three campaigns, you've got the same products being shown in all of them, need to be exactly the same. And then you are excluding essentially the medium intent terms get excluded from the upper funnel campaign, as well as the bottom funnel terms get excluded from the medium campaign and the top campaign. So essentially a keyword will come in, and if it hits those negative keyword lists, it gets pushed down the funnel into your bottom funnel campaign. And then that is where you can use bids and bid adjustments to bid the most amount of money for that bottom funnel campaign.
Is it worth, as a new seller, is it even worth bothering with top of the funnel stuff, knowing that it's not really going to convert for you?
In short, no, but you have to have it there so the funnel doesn't break. But what you can do to, what I was essentially looking to do is I want to get near 100% of my spend as possible into that bottom funnel campaign. So the example I would give is if I'm selling saunas, maybe I'm selling the Sunray Baldwin sauna. Sunray is the brand, Baldwin is the product name. If someone searches the word sauna, I don't want my product ad appearing for that. They could be searching sauna and may mean any number of 100 different things, 100 different products. I don't want to be spending money on that. But if someone searches Sunray Baldwin two-person infrared sauna, I want to be bidding high and making sure that my advert is appearing when someone searches on that. That's someone that's got a high intent. They're probably ready to buy. There's a good chance they're going to come to the website and buy. So I want to get as much of that traffic as possible.
Okay. But you need to have the broader term. You almost to tell Google that you're willing to play the game? Or like I was running a shoe shopping site in my early career, and I would never bid on shoes or even women's shoes or running shoes because it was too broad. And the landing page, they weren't set up to convert on stuff like that. But if you were like New Balance 992 gray women's, something super specific is like, boom, yeah, I want to be at the top for that.
It's exactly the same as that. What you'll find with shopping campaigns is you get generally a cheaper cost per click on those than you would on search text ad campaigns. So over time, if you do find keywords, like the example you gave there, maybe there's something really specific around the brand and the product name, you could create a search text ad campaign and eat up as much of that first page as you possibly can. So you'll have your shopping ads and maybe your search text ads there as well. But the easiest, quickest, and most cost-efficient way to start is to have that approach with the shopping campaigns. And essentially, the only reason you've got those three campaigns in there is because of the way that funnel is set up, and you need to have the keywords flowing into it and to be excluded. You can't just exclude the word sauna, for example, because it'll exclude any search that's got the word sauna in it. So it needs to be in still, but you just don't really want to be spending anything on that traffic.
Do you ever run into brands or suppliers saying, this is all great, you can come on board, you can sell our stuff, but you can't bid on our trademark terms, or you can't bid on our branded search terms?
So that is one of the reasons why I prefer to steer clear from brands who sell direct to customer themselves, because of exactly that type of thing is something I have seen before. So in part of that niche validation that we're doing and the supplier research, I tend to try and avoid those suppliers because of those potential issues you've got with them.
Okay. Now on the ad traffic, like, so what's a click cost these days? Let's talk about kind of the target ROI or some of the math behind driving paid traffic.
So the bids are completely different between those three funnel stages. So that upper funnel traffic, that generic sauna type traffic, I'm bidding anywhere between 2 pence and 5 pence on that. And if I get a couple of clicks a week, it's fine. But that's the sort of CPCs that I'm getting. For that bottom funnel traffic where someone's searching, they're searching specifically for an individual product with a long tail search, I'm bidding up anywhere up to £5 for that type of click, and maybe paying that for it. Quite often it's somewhere in between, pound to £5. But that's the type of CPCs that you'd be sort of expecting to see in that.
Okay. Yeah. So pretty expensive. You got to be reasonably confident this person is ready to convert and my landing page is going to convince them to hit buy. And so there's some elements that you have on there. Obviously, you have the product and lots of images and the price and customer reviews to the extent that you can have them. You have the phone number for somebody. You have any questions about this product? Call us. Does that ring you or does that ring somebody on your team at this point?
Somebody on the team at this point, but me at the start. I've heard that phone ringing at all times.
Okay. What was it like trying to answer questions about this stuff if you're not a camper van person yourself?
There was a bit of faking it until I made it, if I'm completely honest. It's a steep learning curve at first. I mean, obviously, you want to try and do as much as you can to put yourself in a good position to be able to answer the questions. But if you've got 50, 100 products on your site, you're not going to know every specification about everything. So
yeah,
just try and handle it the best you can. If it's a question you don't have the answer to, you can say, I'm just going to check that with so-and-so or my manager, and I'm going to give you a call back and then you go away, get the answer and ring them back. I think you do learn quickly, but don't expect or feel like you have to have every answer straight away.
Right. We had Holly Finnefrock on the show recently, and she said something similar. She was selling like pool and pond fountains and pumps and like crazy stuff that she didn't know anything about. And she was like, oh, I've got some ideas. Let me do a quick research and I'm gonna give you a call back, or I'm gonna check with so-and-so. And it was like, yeah, I'm not being dishonest. And at the same time, it's like kind of this proactive customer support to go out above and beyond and try and make that sale. And having the number on the site adds a certain air of legitimacy and confidence for the customer. Like, okay, there's somebody behind this business that cares and is willing to help me out.
Yeah, completely. And I can't overemphasize how important it is to try and get people on the phone in the early days. If you're able to articulate and present yourself to any kind of normal level, then I think the more that you get potential customers to ring you and speak to you, the more sales you will make. It's not something that is obviously scalable, you sitting around doing that all day, every day, but the handful of phone calls you get at the start are going to be your best opportunities to make those initial sales. And getting those initial sales at the start is just the most important thing. It just gives you that bit of confidence to carry on, the momentum. And then that's really all you need to be focusing on at the start.
Do you remember your first sale moment or that notification from Shopify? What did you sell? What was going on there?
Yeah, I did. It was an awning for a van lifer. One of my favorite people. It was someone who rang me up on a Friday afternoon and wanted to check if something was in stock. So I was like, oh, I'll have to go and check that one with the warehouse quickly and give you a call back. So I had to go and ring the supplier, check it was in stock, everything like that. Had a couple of other questions about delivery, and then he was like, okay, how do I pay? And all of a sudden I thought, oh, how does he actually pay me for this, you know? And so I was like, oh, I'll just double check that the card machine's working. And then I was like, oh, actually, I can send you through this link and you can pay online, and it was all fine. But definitely stumbling over the intricacies of that a little bit at the start.
Yeah, which is risky. It's like, no, let me take down your credit card number right now, and I'll figure out how to process this. Don't want to lose that and risk sending a link that gets buried.
Yeah, so know that before you take the first sale, unlike me.
All right. Well, that's very cool. So up to £5 per click for these bottom of the funnel, high conversion keywords. Is there a target ROI that you're shooting for in terms of the ad spend or return on ad spend?
All depends on your profit margin. So know what you're netting on those products, because the one thing about dropshipping different brands and products is you're going to get a different margin from these different brands in terms of percentage and in terms of actual monetary value. So for me, I work out what my net profit is going to be on all of those products. If I sell it at full retail price, if I sell it at a 5% discount, and then I'm looking at that margin versus my cost to acquire the customer. And anything ROI positive is great at the start.
What's typical in terms of a product margin here, either a product basis or category basis?
I've seen anywhere between 15 to 40% and gross margins on stuff. And that will depend a little bit on the price point of the product. I think if you've got really high ticket stuff, $10,000, $20,000 plus, you might see more like the 15 to 20% range in some cases. But I think on stuff that's edging a bit closer to that 1,000 mark, something typical around 25-30% is pretty standard.
Yeah, so we're talking hundreds of dollars potentially of breathing room to go out and acquire traffic.
Exactly. Acquire the traffic, and you've also just got that sort of margin gives you breathing room for other things as well. If something goes wrong with delivery or something is not quite right with it and you want to be a good business owner and maybe give your customer a little bit of a discount on something, or you know, cover a delivery cost for them or something like that, you've got the room to do that in high ticket, which you don't in low ticket as well. Those sort of razor thin margins, you might get $3 off a $15 product. It's a difficult place to play in.
Yeah. How does that work with some manufacturers might have MAP pricing, you know, minimum advertised price? Is that common in your niche?
In the UK as a market, and I think a couple of others as well, there's no such thing as MAP pricing.
Oh, okay.
So it's actually a kind of different setup here. So people can, in theory, sell things at different levels. And I would say if I was ever doing niche research again, and I had a couple of niches where I'm looking, they both have really good plus points on them and I'm trying to decide between them, a kind of final thing I might look at with that is just, am I seeing price consistency from the other online sellers? If I'm outside of the US anyway, I'd be trying to see how much price consistency is there. In the US, I think a lot of people just advertise at MAP, essentially.
Yeah, which makes it, in a way, it removes that variable. We're like, okay, we're not going to compete on price because everybody's selling the same thing for the same price. So what are we going to compete on? We're going to compete on service, or we're going to compete on delivery or other elements that have to come into play. But it sounds like maybe less of a factor in the UK market.
It is for sure. There is still work to be done around what you said, though. With this type of business, you are going to be a victim of comparison shoppers. Even someone who's searching, doing that search, that long tail search word that we talked about earlier, they might be going and visiting 5-6 different sites that are all selling that same product for the same price. So you've got to get a little bit creative in terms of thinking about, okay, how can I make myself stand out to this customer as the place to buy this from? So that can be different in any niche, but there is a lot of things that you can do around that to build out your offer, as I would call it, so to make you the most attractive company to buy from.
Yeah, what do you do for that? I think that's worth talking about.
For sure. So I think at a base level, risk reversal is a big thing for people. So returns policies, making sure that you've got a good, clear, visible returns policy. Can you even make that the best returns policy in your market? You know, can you offer to pay the postage on returns? Can you extend the returns window a bit longer than what some of your competitors maybe are doing? That could be an advantage on things.
This is something I see. I see 100-day returns advertised on the Camper Nation homepage.
Yes. I think people get scared by that as a business, because they might think, if everyone else is advertising 30-day returns and I'm doing 100 and someone buys from me, maybe my supplier only has a 30-day returns window. What's going to happen in that 30 to 100-day period if someone decides to return it during that? I would say, firstly, the number of people that return during that gap period that I mentioned, say between 30 and 100 days, is a lot less than the additional sales that I'm getting as a result of people feeling like they've got the added security from it. I feel like generally when people want to return something, they do it within the first few days if they're going to do it. And if they don't, the rest of your policy is still the same as everyone else's in terms of, you'll see it needs to be in like new condition. It needs to have all the original packaging. It needs to have all the bits that it came with. So the worst case is you have to just sell that product as an open box and cover your costs from it. And you're basically back at zero at the start.
Do they send it back to you, or do you have storage for this stuff, or do they send it back to the original supplier?
If it's within the supplier's return window, we try and get it returned back to the supplier. And that's what we've done at the start. We now have a 3PL that we use that we take that stock back to, but it's not something you need at the start.
Got it. And then you got to liquidate it. Okay, I got it. Okay.
Yeah. But I would say also the returns rate in high ticket is a lot less than what you'll find in a lot of low ticket niches, particularly, you know, think of things like clothing or anything. It's nothing like that. You know, we've done 1,200, 1,500 orders over the last 18 months, and I think we've had 12 returns maybe in that time.
Okay. Yeah. People are really doing their research up front, making sure this is the right product for their need. And when it shows up and it is what it says it is, then they're going to keep it.
Exactly. And you're selling proper products from proper brands. You know, if you're not willing to stand by these products, you shouldn't sell them. And I think the brands that you'll find are, it's rare that they're making, you know, bad quality products in this type of space.
More with Phil in just a moment, including how he's slowly reducing his reliance on paid traffic with an avalanche SEO strategy, when he felt comfortable walking away from the day job, and what he might do differently if he had to start over. All that and more coming up right after this. Big parenting milestone for us this month. I finally set up investing accounts for the kids. It had been on the to-do list for a while, but it was a chance to talk about the power of compound interest and making money without working for it directly. I think what was most exciting for them was the concept of owning a small piece of a ton of different businesses, and that a lot of the traffic on the road is people going to work for those companies, doing their small part to make them a little bit richer. We also offered a very generous parental match to incentivize them to continue to fund their accounts. But this brings me to my favorite financial tool, Monarch. It's the easy-to-use financial dashboard to track your spending, savings, investments, and more all in one place. I love the net worth tracker, and especially zooming out 6, 12, 24 months and seeing how much progress we've made. I want to invite you to write your own money story with Monarch. Use code SIDEHUSTLE at monarch.com to get your first year of Monarch Core half off at just $50. That's 50% off your first year at monarch.com with code SIDEHUSTLE. You know when you're working for a company and payday just automatically happens every couple weeks? Simple, reliable, easy. But now flip it. You're the boss, it's your business, and you need to pay yourself and your team. That's where our partner Gusto comes in. Gusto is online payroll and benefits software built for small businesses. It's all in one, remote friendly, and incredibly easy to use. So you can pay, hire, onboard, and support your team from anywhere. I've been on an automation kick this year, so Gusto's automatic payroll tax filing is right up my alley. Plus, you can set up simple direct deposits, health benefits, 401ks, you name it. Gusto makes it easy and affordable. There's no hidden fees, no surprises, and it's no wonder why 500,000 small businesses already trust Gusto for their payroll and HR needs. I want to invite you to try Gusto today at gusto.com/sidehustle and get 3 months free when you run your first payroll. That's 3 months of free payroll at gusto.com/sidehustle. One more time, it's Gusto, GUSTO.com/sidehustle. Now, I'm starting to see some more educational style content on the site rather than just product listings. We have like how to measure caravan awnings. We have a guide on how to put up a caravan awning. So trying to wean off of purely paid traffic as a customer acquisition and try and get some more organic juice flowing. Has that been working?
Yeah, I would say, honestly, one of, if not the biggest lever that we've managed to pull in the last year or so is organic traffic. As much as I talked about getting those early sales and getting people to your product pages and building momentum through ads that way, I think organic traffic and organic search is probably the biggest opportunity that you've got as an e-commerce business. It's the biggest section of the market. It's free traffic that you don't have to pay for every time. So your cost to, you know, acquisition costs are better. You've got better margins, but you just need to be realistic about the terms that you're going to be able to rank for, particularly at the start. If you're the sauna seller, you don't want to be going and trying and doing all your best efforts at a 6 month old business to try and rank for the word sauna, because it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
You've got a thousand other people trying to do that. So it's a very different approach to that.
You've got some product comparison style posts. It's almost taken a page out of an affiliate marketing playbook, where like, here are the best portable power stations for space heaters, like a very specific use case. Best portable power station for tailgating, another very specific use case. So it's like not just best portable power station, but like what is the longer tail version of that? We've got EcoFlow Delta 2 Max versus Delta 3 Series, the ultimate power station comparison. So kind of helping people in their decision-making process. And instead of an outbound affiliate link, it could be an internal product sales page link.
Exactly. Yeah, it all comes about from a method called avalanche SEO is what I apply to this, which is basically the idea that websites are essentially put into different tier levels based on how much daily organic traffic they're getting. So, for example, if you're getting between 0 and 10 daily visitors from Google, you're in level 0. If you're getting 10 to 20, you're in level 1. 20 to 50, level 2. And Google is realistically only going to let you show up for keywords that either match, that closely match your tier level. So if I'm thinking about the word sauna, probably gets by itself 20,000 searches a month. So my site with its 5 daily organic visitors is never going to be able to rank for that word, maybe ever, but definitely not at the start. So I want to be going after the keywords that are within my wheelhouse, essentially, that are in my tier level. So that's why you see all of these informational terms. They're really overlooked terms. You know, the other competitors are trying, they're the ones trying to go after sauna and, you know, failing probably at it. They're not interested in the informational stuff around it. To find those terms, a pretty simple process. One tool primarily to do it, Answer the Public. Neil Patel getting another shout out from me here. But Answer the Public, go to that, typed in the product category that I want to start building content around. So if we take saunas in this case, you go and search sauna in Answer the Public, and it will give you essentially a list of all the questions that people are asking around that product on Google, now also on AI, YouTube, other channels as well. And each of those terms I'm going to look at as a potential keyword that I could be building content around and targeting for it. So that's why you see all of those informational type pieces on there. So there tend to be low competition, info-based content, things like, should you sauna after eating, or, you know, is sauna good if you're pregnant? You do that at scale. You build lots of those articles that are maybe all going to bring in 10, 20, 50 visitors to them, but you build 100 of those, and all of a sudden you've got a base of organic traffic that then allows you to move up the tiers and start going over those, going after those slightly more competitive words over time. And that's kind of what we've applied to Campanation.
Okay, very methodical stair-step approach to building out this body of content. Are you writing this stuff yourself? You got a team member who's helping out?
So initially, I wrote some of it myself, and I still do tweak things. But in all honesty, I've outsourced a lot of that work to a freelancer on Fiverr, who I pay a few dollars per article to follow along a very specific SOP that we've built. But in terms of the content generation, we're layering a couple of AI tools on top of each other and then having a human sort of tweak it at the end to make sure it's all readable and correct.
Got it. Okay, Answer the Public, Uber Suggest, Shopify, anything else on the tools and tech side that you swear by to help run this business?
Honestly, you don't have to spend any money to do some of this. You can just use Google at the start. I think people overlook it as a keyword research tool, even without any plugins or anything like that. If you know a product type that you're selling, you can go to Google, type in that word, and see what some of the predictive searches are around it. You can put the word what before it, how, if, why, and you'll get predicted results from Google. And that can quite quickly turn into a month's worth of content that you've got to create there. Even things like the people also ask or people also search for categories, they really are gold mines for potential content that you can create and keywords that you can target, because it's real data that Google was, put together based on what people are searching for.
Yeah, I used to do the same thing. Would put in a seed keyword like side hustles or ways to make money, and then would go through the alphabet, like A, and then see what the auto suggest would fill in, B, and see, oh, okay, ways to make money by something. You're like, oh, I never would have thought of that. But sure enough, there is some level of interest around it.
That was my Friday nights at times, going into Google, A, B, C on the keyboard and finding the different terms to go after. So yeah, I think that's a really key way of doing it. And I also think there's other overtime terms that are really useful to start ranking for that are overlooked, and that is some of that versus type content that you've found. So if you're carrying brands that have some search volume behind them, and maybe their products have some search volume as well, you'll find that there are a lot of people searching versus between different products, different brands, and those are quite high intent searches that you can create pieces of content around and actually drive sales from those as well. And similarly with collection pages, you'll find that maybe you're not going to be able to rank for sauna now or ever, but maybe two-person infrared saunas, you might be able to have a better chance of ranking at. And if you can build a good collection page around that with some useful content on, then you've got a pretty good chance of doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. At what point do you feel comfortable calling it quits at the day job and saying, okay, this has legs, I'm going all in on this?
I think erring on a little bit of the side of caution, I wanted to have a good 6 months of, first of all, savings built up from the business, but I also wanted to see a pretty consistent run rate over that time period as well. So things can be a little bit streaky at the start, particularly when you're in a high ticket niche where the number of orders you're doing is not a lot and the value of the orders is quite a lot. So I wanted to see a stable and growing level over 6 months. So yeah, for me, that was hitting 40,000 in revenue a month for 6 months in a row. That was when I felt like it was a good enough time to step away.
Yeah, not just 1 month. That could have been a blip on the radar, but I want to see it consistently over the course of half a year.
Yeah, exactly.
I was kind of the same way. I wanted to have like this track record of revenue going back 6 or 12 months that was at least going to cover my monthly expenses, so I wasn't going to have to go in the hole once I had left the day job. Other people are like, no, burn the ships, and sometimes even pre-revenue, I'm gonna quit. I'm confident I'm going to make it work, but no, I'm more in the risk-averse camp like yourself there.
Yeah.
Now, earlier you said, look, this is not passive income. So where is your time going today in terms of managing the operations?
So we have a small team now behind me. So I think one of the biggest things you can do is leverage your own time to be spending it as effectively as possible. So a big time sap previously was customer service. It was fulfilling orders. It was, where's my order? Where's my tracking link? Answering that type of stuff. And so that was the first thing I really outsourced to get off my plate. So getting a virtual assistant in to basically cover that type of stuff. That then frees me up to be doing more things that are a little bit more around growing the business. So I still look after the ads. I still handle some of the larger sales projects that we work on. So I'm still speaking to customers from day to day. But basically everything from the point of sale onwards is not really touched by me at all anymore, unless there's a big issue that, needs me to make a decision on. Everything else is handled elsewhere.
Yeah. Are you actively trying to grow the inventory, like onboard new suppliers?
Yeah, so for me, it's been a staggered approach. So starting with dropshipping, so holding no stock. So now we've started dipping our toe into the water of holding some of our stock, holding some stock of our best-selling SKUs that we've got. So we've built up that sales data and we can confidently say, you know, these are the handful of products that we know are going to sell. And now we're starting to look beyond dropshipping. So I think dropshipping is very much the quickest, and cautious of saying easiest, but quickest and easiest and least risky route to starting one of these businesses. But I don't see it as the end point. I see it as a means to getting to a point.
Does holding your own inventory allow you better margins, or what's the advantage of that?
I'd say it's threefold, maybe. Margins, for sure. If you can place a bulk order with a supplier, you might get 10%, 15% better margin on those products, maybe more. And when you're talking about maybe a product that retails for a couple of £1,000, that's meaningful additional money.
Yeah, and you're confident, like, look, we've been selling five of these a month for 5 months. Okay, you know it's going to turn.
Exactly that. And also what you'll find is one of the drawbacks of dropshipping is you're reliant on someone else's logistics to deliver the product a lot of the time. You don't always know 100% if something's going to be in stock. Not every supplier has got a sophisticated stock management tool that can plug in. So if you hold that stock, you know you've got it. If the supplier goes out of stock, then maybe you've still got your own stock of it and you can sell it. So yeah, that's the kind of the real plus points for it.
Got it. Anything you would do differently if you were starting over, or advice you would give to somebody looking to get started in a similar business?
I think I had a little bit of a lack of belief that people would really come online and spend this kind of money on a website, on an e-commerce website, with little old me running it. And maybe there was a bit of an element of self-doubt in that. But I would actually say if I went back to the start now, I'd probably go even more high ticket than I have done with this niche. I think if I was going to start over again, maybe at some point in the future with another store, I'd go even, yeah, the higher the ticket, the better to some extent.
Yeah, is there an upper limit, you think? I mean, people, like, the higher the price, the more likely somebody's going to want to get on the phone. And so there's more work, labor, intelligence involved in making that sale. I don't know. What have you found?
I think the more potential problems or stumbling blocks that someone has pre-sale, the more opportunity you have as a dropshipper, seller of other people's products, to help that person answer their questions and ultimately win the sale from it. I think if there's no work or guidance that's needed pre-sale, that's when you can very much be a victim of comparison shopping. Whereas if someone's going to have questions around installation, sizing, requirements, any of that type of stuff, if you can provide value to them before you take their credit card details, I think there's actually a really big opportunity there for you to be able to win those sales rather in a way that's not just based around price.
Has there been any big surprises or horror stories or, you know, things that have gone wrong over the last year and a half of doing this?
The biggest issue we had was we had a bunch of products that needed to be installed. They were being built, needed to be installed. We had a national installation company that was going to be installing all of them for us. And then 2 days before the first installation, they pulled out of everything, out of all of the projects. So we had to scramble last minute to find these local companies to come and install these products for us for a customer. So that was probably that sort of headache that you get, very different to what you'd get normally in a corporate role. That type of thing was a pretty steep learning curve, a bit of a wake-up call.
A little bit of a fire drill, but never a dull moment. We got to figure this out. We got to deliver for the customers.
Exactly.
Well, Phil, this has been awesome. What's next for you? Where do you want to take Camper Nation? What's got you excited?
I think, honestly, just looking towards the future, I think we are thinking about getting some of our own products manufactured now. A bit of a staggered approach from drop shipping, holding some stock, and then now we want to start looking at getting our own brand of products together, designing some products, getting those better margins on it, and releasing that hopefully sometime in the next year.
Yeah, that's an exciting next step. Bigger risk involved, upfront capital involved, but hopefully a long-term win. And it's in the name, right? It's Side Hustle Nation. It's Camper Nation. It's like this persona. And maybe they keep coming back to you for the next thing that they know to build out their epic camping setup.
Exactly. I think Side Hustle Nation, Camper Nation is the collab that neither of us realized that we needed. But yeah.
Yes. Awesome. Well, campernation.co.uk. Encourage you to check out the site. It is phil@campernation.co.uk if you want to send an email. And you're also a part of Jaden Clark's 1% Ecom Club on school, which Jaden was an episode earlier this year. I think 736 was his episode number, so we'll link that up as well. Let's wrap this thing up with your number one tip for Side Hustle Nation.
Don't let revenue clouds your judgment. Focus on profit.
Ooh, I love that. What is it? What's the line? Revenue is vanity, profit is sanity or something. Cash flow is king.
Yeah, exactly. It's so true. Yeah. There's another one. It's like revenue feeds the ego and profit feeds the family is another one I've heard.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's like, oh, I've got $1 million business, but I spent 1.1 on ads. Like, well, you know, make sure we got some margin in there to play with. Very, very cool. I really liked this episode from the standpoint of, look, I can start low risk. I can build this up in a really systematic way. I can target these long tail, high buyer intent type of keywords, and then I can build out this organic traffic machine, and now I can invest in making my own products, really turn this into a really valuable e-com asset. So Phil, impressive what you've built and what you'll continue to build, campernation.co.uk. We've done a couple other recent dropshipping or e-commerce episodes that might be worth checking out if you like this model. 704 was with Holly, the municipal pool fountain stuff. That was a really interesting one. And 736 with Jaden Clark. All, I believe, drawing inspiration from Ben and John at Dropship Breakthrough. Ben's been on the show as well, so we can link up all of those in the show notes. And if dropshipping is not your thing, I appreciate you giving it a fair shake, sticking around to the end in this episode. If you want to create a personalized playlist of some episodes that might be more up your alley, you can do that at hustle.show. Just answer a few short multiple choice questions, and it'll spit back out a curated playlist of some of our greatest hits episodes based on your answers. Hopefully, they'll be more impactful for you. Hustle.show for that. Big thanks to Phil for sharing his insight. Big thanks to our sponsors for helping make this content free for everyone. SideHustleNation.com/deals is where you'll find all the latest offers from our sponsors in one place. That is it for me. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you're finding value in the show, the greatest compliment is to share it with a friend. Fire off that text message. Maybe it's that van lifer in your life that needs to hear this. Until next time, let's go out there and make something happen. And I'll catch you in the next edition of The Side Hustle Show. Hustle on.